To ask him about this matter, NASA Administrator James Webb told Von Braun pointedly. His answer was to be, "Everything related to my past activity in Germany is well known to the U.S. government." In the end, nothing much came of the book in the Western world. The narrative mixed damaging facts with completely fabricated scenes, explains Von Braun's biographer Michael J. Neufeld, which made the book easy to discount. When NASA learned that the book's author, Julius Mauder, worked as an intelligence agent for the East German secret police, the revelations lost their potential power. If need be, Mauder's book could be discounted as Soviet-engineered lies, meant only to damage the prestige of the U.S. space program. The Secret of Huntsville, the true career of rocket baron Wernher von Braun, was a success in the Eastern Bloc. It was also translated into Russian and sold 500,000 copies in the Soviet Union. The book inspired a Soviet-sponsored film, Die Gefrorenen Blitze, Frozen Lightning, also written by Mauder and released by the East German state film studio DEFA, Deutsche Film Aktiengesellschaft, in 1967. The same year, West German prosecutors opened a new Dora Nordhausen trial, this one called the Essen-Dora trial. An SS guard, a Gestapo official, and the chief of security for the V2 were all charged with war crimes that took place while V weapons were being built in the Middlework tunnel complex. Middlework general manager and former paperclip scientist George Ricke was called as a witness, as was Wernher von Braun. Ricke, who lived in Germany, took the stand. He testified under oath that he did not know about the Dora Nordhausen concentration camp, that he learned about it after the war. "I don't know much more because they were secret concentration camps," Ricke told the court. "It was a secret commando group in charge, eyes only. There were bad, catastrophic conditions at Nordhausen, but I learned about this only after the war." This was an absurd misrepresentation of the truth. Back in America, NASA General Counsel refused to send the star of their space program to Germany. This would open Pandora's box. Instead, they allowed von Braun to deliver oral testimony at a West German consulate in the United States. As a venue, NASA lawyers suggested New Orleans, Louisiana, a place about as far away from the media glare as there was. Representing the Soviet bloc survivors of Dora Nordhausen was an East German lawyer by the name of Dr. Friedrich Kaul. Upon learning that von Braun would not be coming to Germany, Dr. Kaul arranged to travel to New Orleans to take von Braun's testimony himself. Kaul was a supremely skillful lawyer, and he had information on von Braun that was damaging. According to Michael J. Neufeld, the U.S. government knew that Dr. Kaul had served as legal advisor on Die Gefrorenen Blitze, and that Kaul's goal in interviewing von Braun was to broadcast the connection between the rocket engineer, the SS, and the concentration camps. NASA's moon program would never survive that kind of publicity, and the State Department denied Dr. Friedrich Kaul a visa. Instead, at the courthouse in Louisiana, von Braun answered questions put to him by a German judge. As the U.S. Army had done with the 1947 Nordhausen trial, the government sealed von Braun's testimony. Word leaked to the news media that von Braun had been deposed for a war crimes trial, causing von Braun to issue a brief statement on the matter. He said he had nothing to hide and I am not implicated. When a reporter asked if there had been any concentration camp prisoners used as slave laborers at Peenemünde, von Braun said no. The judge prosecuting the Essen-Dora trial also took the testimony of General Dornberger in Mexico, where the now-retired Dornberger spent winters with his wife. Some months later, von Braun and Dornberger corresponded about the matter. In regards to the testimony, Fortunately, I too have heard nothing more, wrote Von Braun. No news was good news for both men. After the Apollo 11 moon landing in July 1969, columnist Drew Pearson, whose fierce exposés of Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber had helped to banish the man from America, wrote in his column that Von Braun had been a member of the SS. But Von Braun's glory had reached epic proportions, and Pearson's article went by relatively unnoticed. Von Braun was an American hero. Citizens all across the nation showered him with praise, glory, and the confetti of ticker tape parades. After the Apollo space program ended, Von Braun moved into the private sector. In his new life as a defense contractor, he traveled the world and met its leaders, including Indira Gandhi, the Shah of Iran, and Crown Prince Juan Carlos of Spain. In 1973, he decided to take up flying, and in June of that year, he applied to get his pilot's license with the Federal Aviation Administration. This required a physical and a body X-ray, which revealed a dark shadow on his kidney. Von Braun had terminal cancer, but would live for another 4 years. The year before he died, there was a motion inside the Ford White House to award Wernher von Braun the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The idea almost passed until one of President Ford's senior advisors, David Gergen, famously wrote in a note passed to colleagues, "Sorry, but I can't support the idea of giving the Medal of Freedom to a former Nazi whose V-2 was fired into over 3,000 British and Belgian cities. He has given valuable service to the U.S. since, but frankly, he has gotten as good as he has given." Von Braun was awarded the Medal of Science instead. He died on June 16, 1977. His tombstone in Alexandria, Virginia, cites Psalm 19:1, invoking God, glory, heaven, and earth. It would be another 8 years before the intrepid CNN reporter Linda Hunt became the first person to crack the pretense of Wernher von Braun. It took a Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, record release to reveal Wernher von Braun's Nazi past. Dr. Hubertus Strughold, though never as famous as Wernher von Braun, played an equally vital role in the U.S. space program in the field of medicine. In November 1948, 15 months after Strughold arrived at the School of Aviation Medicine at Randolph Air Force Base, he and Commandant Harry Armstrong hosted the first ever U.S. military panel discussion on biology in space. Strughold served as professional advisor to Harry Armstrong at the SAM, and he oversaw the work of approximately 34 German colleagues under Operation Paperclip contracts there. Strughold's broader vision, which he shared with Armstrong, was to create a space medicine program for the U.S. Air Force. In 1948, the notion of human spaceflight was still considered science fiction by most. But Strughold's team had recently conducted a groundbreaking experiment with Von Braun's rocket team at White Sands, the results of which they desired to make public. On June 11, 1948, a 9-pound rhesus monkey named Albert was strapped into a harness inside the nose cone of a V-2 rocket and jettisoned into space. Albert's pressurized space capsule, its harness and its cage, had been designed by Dr. Strughold and his team. The V-2 rocket carrying Albert traveled to an altitude of 39 miles. Albert died of suffocation during the 6-minute flight. But for Dr. Strughold, the monkey's voyage signified the momentous first step toward human spaceflight. Armstrong and Strughold's Biology in Space panel was co-sponsored by the Air Surgeon, the National Research Council, and the Medical Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Wright Lab. For the first time ever in America, space medicine was now being looked at as a legitimate military science. 2 months later, in January 1949, Armstrong and Strughold decided it was time to seek funding for a new department inside the SAM, dedicated solely to researching space medicine. For this, Armstrong later explained, we needed much larger accommodations, more space and facilities, and much more sophisticated research equipment. Armstrong traveled to Washington, D.C. to sell the idea to Congress and to explain that he and Dr. Strughold needed between 15 and 20 years lead time to do the necessary research to prepare humans for space travel. Congress approved Armstrong's idea. There were no wild headlines, Armstrong later explained. The Department of Space Medicine at the SAM opened with little fanfare on February 8, 1949. I appointed myself director of the new aerospace laboratory, not Dr. Strughold, since there were still some lingering enmity toward the Germans, Armstrong told an Air Force historian in 1976. But just a few months after the department officially opened, Armstrong was transferred to the Pentagon to serve as Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. The man he was replacing was his longtime mentor, Major General Malcolm Groh. Back in Texas, Dr. Strughold was promoted to the position of Scientific Director of the Department of Space Medicine at SAM. Strughold continued to oversee the professional activities of the paperclip scientists. He also played an active role in further recruiting endeavors. In the fall of 1949, he traveled to Germany to try to facilitate the hiring of Dr. Siegfried Ruf, Strughold's longtime colleague and one of the doctors tried and acquitted at the Nuremberg doctor's trial. Siegfried Ruf was the Luftwaffe doctor who had overseen Rascher's medical murder experiments at Dachau. Information about Ruf's recruitment was leaked to journalist Drew Pearson, who allegedly threatened to tell the president if Dr. Ruf came to the United States as part of Operation Paperclip. Ruf's contract never materialized. A second defendant acquitted at the Nuremberg doctor's trial was able to secure a paperclip contract with Dr. Strughold's help. Conrad Schaffer, the thirst and thirst-quenching expert, who had participated in the planning and execution of the saltwater experiments at Dachau, arrived at the School of Aviation Medicine in August 1949. In Texas, Schaffer's military research was supervised by Dr. Strughold and an Air Force captain named Seymour Schwartz. During Schaffer's time at SAM, he worked in three departments, internal medicine, radiobiology, and pharmacology. One of his research projects involved an effort to make Mississippi River water drinkable. Conrad Schaffer's American supervisor found him inept. The scientist Schaffer has been singularly unsuccessful in producing any finished work and has displayed very little real scientific acumen, Captain Schwartz wrote. The experience of this headquarters indicates that this man is a most ineffective research worker. And on the basis of his performance here, his future worth to the U.S. Armed Forces is nil. In a letter to the Director of Intelligence at U.S. Air Force Headquarters in Washington, D.C., in March 1951, Captain Schwartz requested that Schaffer's paperclip contract be terminated and that he be sent back to Germany. The Air Force terminated Schaffer's contract, but the German doctor refused to leave the United States. Thanks to expedited protocols put in place by the JOA, Schaffer was already in possession of a valid U.S. immigration visa by the time it was determined that he was incompetent. He moved to New York City to work in the private sector. In the early 1950s, the School of Aviation Medicine and its Department of Space Medicine swiftly gained momentum as formidable medical research laboratories. The Journal of Aviation Medicine began publishing articles on space medicine, including ones written by paperclip scientists, and covering topics like weightlessness, urinating in zero gravity, and the effects of cosmic radiation on humans. There was also classified military research going on at the SAM, including experiments involving human test subjects. In January 1994, President Clinton created the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments to investigate and report on the use of human beings in medical research related to Cold War atomic tests. The advisory committee found many of these experiments to be criminal and to be in violation of the Nuremberg Code, including studies conducted by German doctors with the SAM. Starting in 1951, the Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, and the Department of Defense conducted above-ground nuclear weapons tests in the Nevada desert at a facility called the Nevada Proving Ground and later renamed the Nevada Test Site. The experiments were designed to determine how soldiers and airmen would perform on the nuclear battlefield. The AEC and the DOD agreed that subjecting soldiers to blast and radiation effects of various-sized atomic bombs was required to accurately prepare for a nuclear war. Colonel John E. Pickering was the director of medical research at the SAM in the early 1950s. In this capacity, Pickering oversaw the research of two German doctors working on a group of AEC studies involving flash blindness, the temporary or permanent blindness caused by looking at a nuclear weapon during detonation. According to testimony Colonel Pickering gave to the advisory committee in 1994, one set of flash blindness studies had been suggested by Dr. Strughold. Pickering said Strughold was interested in learning about permanent eye damage based on the fact that he himself had been partially blinded in one eye as a boy after watching a solar eclipse with a faulty viewing glass. "That's the thing that gave us curiosity," Pickering recalled of Strughold's accident. Among the paperclip scientists who carried out the initial flash blindness studies were Heinrich Rose and Konrad Büttner. Both men had been working for the U.S. government since the fall of 1945, when Dr. Strughold first recommended them for employment at the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg. And like so many of Strughold's close Luftwaffe colleagues, Rose and Büttner had been Nazi ideologues during the war. Both men were long-term members of the Nazi Party and also members of the SA. For the first set of flash blindness studies, Rose and Büttner's test subjects were large pigs. The two doctors calculated that the flash of a 20-kiloton atomic bomb could produce retinal burns as far as 40 miles from ground zero. As the atomic test progressed, the Atomic Energy Commission sought more specific data regarding humans. In the fall of 1951, for an atomic test series called Operation Buster Jangle, soldier volunteers were asked to stare at a nuclear explosion from varying distances. Crew flying in C-54 aircraft approximately 9 miles from ground zero were told to look out the windows of the airplane when the bomb went off. Some wore protective eye goggles while others did not. No visual handicaps were reported, according to Pickering. In the spring of 1952, for an atomic test series called Operation Tumbler Snapper, a trailer was set up on the Nevada desert floor, with porthole-like windows at viewing range. Soldier volunteers were asked to sit in front of the windows and stare at the nuclear explosion. The distance from ground zero was also approximately 9 miles, only this time the soldiers were at blast level. One of the volunteers in the viewing trailer was Colonel Pickering, who said that some of the human test subjects were given protective eye goggles to wear, but others were asked to observe the fireball with the naked eye. Two soldiers had their eyeballs burned, and the trailer tests were suspended. In the spring of 1953, for an atomic test series called Operation Upshot Knothole, soldier volunteers were asked to perform duck and cover drills inside 5-foot-deep trenches that had been dug into the desert floor several miles from Ground Zero. The men were specifically instructed not to look at the atomic blast. But curiosity got the better of at least one young officer, a 22-year-old lieutenant identified in declassified records as SH. Instead of facing away from the blast, the lieutenant looked over his left shoulder in the direction of the atomic bomb when it detonated with a force of 43 kilotons. He didn't wear his goggles and he looked, Colonel Pickering told President Clinton's advisory committee in 1994. Because light enters the eye through the cornea and is refracted when it hits the lens, Pickering explained, images are flipped upside down. As a result, the image of an inverted nuclear fireball was seared on the lieutenant's retina forever, leaving what Pickering described as probably one of the most beautiful images of a fireball you'd ever see in your life. Pickering said that doctors at the SAM kept a photograph of the man's eyeball for their collection. The advisory committee determined that the SAM continued its classified flash blindness studies until at least 1962, but that most of the records had been lost or destroyed. Dr. Strughold's personal research efforts remained focused on space medicine. Monkey astronaut rocket tests at White Sands progressed. On June 19, 1949, a monkey named Albert II was blasted off into space. During that flight, Strughold and his team monitored Albert II's vitals as the V-2 carried him past the Kármán line, the point at which outer space begins, and reached an altitude of 83 miles. Albert II died back on Earth, on impact, when his parachute failed to open. By 1952, Strughold had succeeded in convincing the Air Force to fund the construction of a sealed chamber, or capsule, to be used for space medicine research on humans. The cabin was designed by fellow paperclip scientist Fritz Haber, brother of Heinz Haber, and completed in 1954. The sealed chamber was 100 cubic square feet, with a single seat and an instrument panel, and was meant to duplicate the conditions that an astronaut would experience during a voyage to the moon. The first human test was conducted in March 1956, when an airman named D.F. Smith spent 24 hours inside the chamber, performing various tasks while being monitored by Strughold and his team. Approximately 2 years later, in February 1958, pilot Donald G. Farrell, a 23-year-old native of the Bronx, chosen from a pool of rigorously screened airmen, stepped into the chamber for 7 consecutive days and nights. This time period, Strughold explained, was inspired by Jules Verne's prediction of how long it would take for a spaceship to get to the moon. During the test, Strughold and Hans-Georg Klammann, Strughold's former assistant during the Luftwaffe years, as well as 2 Air Force colleagues, monitored Donald Farrell's vitals and his ability to perform tasks. The space capsule simulator test with Airman Donald Farrell attracted all kinds of media attention. On the 7th and final day, Texas Senator Lyndon B. Johnson stopped by the School of Aviation Medicine to personally escort Farrell out of the chamber and join him at a press conference. Dr. Strughold stood by Farrell's side, as did General Otis Benson, the man who had tried and failed to find Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber a teaching position so he could remain in America. Benson singled out Strughold for his excellent work in the name of medical science. So excited was Lyndon Johnson by the event that he flew Dr. Strughold and his team to Washington, D.C., to attend a luncheon with 70 congressmen, the Secretary of the Air Force, and half a dozen 4-star generals. Strughold later recalled the event. After the soup, Lyndon Johnson asked me to give a 5-minute talk about the scope of space medicine and the meaning of the experiment. Hubertus Strughold, like Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger, was now an accepted member of the U.S. military scientific elite. But there was a bump in the road. In May 1958, Time magazine featured a piece about Strughold, showering him with praise as America's space medicine research pioneer. In response, the widely read Saturday Review published an editorial by Julian Bach Jr., a former war correspondent for the Army Talks series of pamphlets for GIs and the first American correspondent to report in the general press on medical experiments on human beings by Nazi doctors during World War II. Bach's editorial was called Himmler the Scientist. In it, the war correspondent reminded the public of the human experiments that the Nazi doctors had conducted on prisoners in concentration camps. The German doctors carving them up were medical men of stature in many cases, wrote Bach. Only the fewest were quacks. Bach correctly linked Strughold to the freezing experiments at Dachau, stating that at minimum he had knowledge of them. This was the first time the public had heard anything about Dr. Strughold having knowledge of the medical murder experiments, a fact he had previously been able to keep hidden. The article prompted an investigation at the federal level. Because Strughold had become a U.S. citizen 2 years prior, in 1956, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, was now compelled to investigate. But after checking with the Air Force, the INS released a statement saying that Strughold had been appropriately investigated before becoming a U.S. citizen. The INS had not been shown Strughold's OMGUS security report or his classified dossier. If it had been, INS would have learned that military intelligence had concluded that Strughold's successful career under Hitler would seem to indicate that he must be in full accord with Nazism. In October 1958, the 29th meeting of the Aeromedical Association convened in San Antonio, Texas, for a day-long symposium, Aviation Medicine on the Threshold of Space. The group's first international convention had taken place at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel 21 years before. Dr. Strughold and Harry Armstrong had both been in attendance. Here they were together again. Armstrong and Strughold were co-hosts of the event. General Dornberger delivered a speech. 11 of the 47 scientists in attendance had been brought to America from Germany as part of Project Paperclip. They were American citizens now. A prolific writer, Strughold authored papers and journals, sometimes more than a dozen in a year. He had contributed a piece about space cabins to the Collier's magazine series. He created new, space-related nomenclature, including the words bioastronautics, gravisphere, ecosphere, and astrobiology. He studied jet lag, how the body responds to flight, and wrote a book about his findings, Your Body Clock. In 1964, he was interviewed by the space writer and journalist Shirley Thomas for her 8-volume series, Men of Space. Now, with nearly 2 decades of distance between himself and his Nazi past, and with so many accolades to his name, Strughold began to construct a fictional past for himself, one in which he had actually been an opponent of the Nazis. "I was against Hitler and his beliefs," Strughold told Shirley Thomas. "I sometimes tried to hide myself because my life was in danger from the Nazis," he said. This was, of course, absurd. Strughold was among the highest-ranking doctor professors in the Luftwaffe. "Were you ever forced to join the Nazi Party?" Thomas asked. "It was tried," Strughold said. "They tried it, but failed." Strughold told Thomas that the same went for the staff at his Aviation Medical Research Institute in Berlin. Only the janitor and the man who took care of the animals were members of the Nazi Party, Strughold lied. It was as if his close colleagues from the Nazi era, Doctors Siegfried Ruf, Conrad Schaffer, Hermann Becker-Friesing, and Oskar Schroeder, did not exist. People began to look harder into the past. On September 3, 1973, Simon Wiesenthal, a freelance Nazi hunter who had played a role in the capture of Adolf Eichmann, wrote to Dr. Adalbert Ruckarl, director of the Central Office of the State Justice Administration for the Investigation of National Socialist Crimes in Ludwigsburg, Germany. "I have information that Dr. Hubertus Strughold participated in experiments with human beings in Ravensbrück," Wiesenthal wrote. "We don't have the name in our archive. The information states that the experiments were in context of the German Air Force." Dr. Adalbert Ruckarl told Simon Wiesenthal that he would look into it. A few months later, Ruckarl wrote back to Wiesenthal to say that a comprehensive investigation had been done and that the Central Office could not find any direct evidence of Strughold's personal participation in the medical crimes. Ruckarl provided Wiesenthal with a copy of the documents pertaining to the conference, "Medical Problems of Sea Distress and Winter Distress," at the Hotel Deutscherhof in Nuremberg in 1942, including the travel expenses that Strughold had submitted and the amount he was paid to attend. The Luftwaffe doctors in attendance had discussed the medical data of murdered people, but knowledge was not a crime, and there was no further action for the Central Office of the State Justice Administration to take, Ruckarl said. A few months later, toward the end of 1973, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service announced that it was investigating Strughold and 34 other long-dormant cases of Nazi war criminal suspects living in the United States. That Strughold's name was on the list, which was published in the New York Times, came as a shock to him. Strughold rehearsed a succinct response for reporters, the same as Von Braun had when allegations arose. "I was cleared before I came here, before I was hired," Strughold said. Leaders of Jewish groups sprang into action, and Charles R. Allen Jr., the former senior editor of The Nation, writing for Jewish Currents, presented evidence about Strughold's knowledge of human experiments. Allen had acquired the first public copy of the proceedings of the Nuremberg Medical Conference at the Hotel Deutscherhof in 1942, which included a list of those in attendance. On this list were five other Nazi doctors who had worked in America under Project Paperclip: Major General Walter Schreiber, Conrad Schaffer, Hans Georg Klammen, Conrad Büttner, and Theodore Benzinger. But neither Charles R. Allen Jr. nor anyone else involved in the Strughold expose appears to have recognized any of these names. 20 years prior, Major General Walter Schreiber had been fired from the SAM and banished to Argentina, and Conrad Schaffer had been fired from the SAM and moved to New York. But when this story broke in 1973, Hans Georg Klammen, Conrad Büttner, and Theodore Benzinger had all been gainfully employed by the U.S. government for decades and were now living the American dream. The cloud of suspicion hung over Strughold. Ralph Blumenthal wrote a follow-up article in the New York Times in November of 1974, describing the freezing experiments in detail. "Victims were forced to remain naked outdoors or in tanks of ice water. Tests were made periodically as they were freezing to death. The victims suffered agonizing deaths, after which they were dissected for data." INS Director Leonard Chapman made inquiries with the U.S. Air Force and was told that there was no derogatory information on Strughold. The case was closed yet again. Now, more than ever, Strughold felt the need to promote the fiction that he was anti-Nazi. In an Air Force oral history interview that took place 2 days after Blumenthal's piece ran in the New York Times, Strughold told interviewer James C. Hasdorff that during the war, he constantly feared for his life. He said that he had been written up on Hitler's so-called enemy list. Strughold insisted that at one point, shortly after the attempted assassination of Hitler by Count Klaus von Stauffenberg in July 1944, he, Strughold, had to go into hiding because he was receiving death threats, that he went from farmhouse to farmhouse until it was finally safe to return to Berlin. This was an absurd distortion of reality. In the months after the Stauffenberg incident, in the winter of 1945, Hubertus Strughold had been promoted to full colonel in the Luftwaffe reserves. 3 years passed. The spotlight moved away. In a ceremony on July 19, 1977, a bronze plaque bearing a portrait of Dr. Hubertus Strughold was unveiled in San Antonio, Texas, in the foyer at the Aeromedical Library at the School of Aerospace Medicine. The library, which was the largest medical library in the U.S. Air Force, was being dedicated to Dr. Hubertus Strughold, the father of space medicine. The Air Force promised that Strughold's bronze plaque will be permanently displayed in the foyer of the library, but permanence is impossible to predict. Only time tells what lasts. Chapter 22, Legacy. In the 1960s, what Operation Paperclip left behind in the country it recruited from reveals contradictory truths about the program's legacy. A watershed event occurred in 1963 when the West German courts opened the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial. This was the first large-scale public trial of Holocaust perpetrators to take place inside Germany. There had been one Auschwitz trial previously in Krakow, Poland, in 1947, in which a number of camp functionaries were tried, including Auschwitz Commandant Rudolf Hess, who was sentenced to death and hanged. But before the Frankfurt Auschwitz trial, which ran through 1965, Germany had not conducted any major war crimes trials of its own. The Nuremberg trials, of course, were presided over by the Allied forces. At the Frankfurt Auschwitz trial, 360 witnesses from 19 countries, including 211 Auschwitz survivors, would confront the accused. The judges hearing the case were all Germans. Throughout the 1950s, Germany's political and legal elite had opposed holding these kinds of trials for a variety of reasons, but mostly because it would likely generate additional trials. Just as it behooved U.S. military intelligence to keep the details of Operation Paperclip a secret, so it went for many German jurists. Thousands of their fellow citizens had committed heinous crimes during the war and were now living perfectly normal and sometimes very productive lives. But in 1963, with the trial underway, for the first time since 1945, people in Germany were openly talking about gas chambers, death camps, and the Holocaust. The trial was triggered by a letter I received, recalled Hermann Langbein, the secretary of the International Auschwitz Committee. It was mailed to me by an Auschwitz survivor, a German named Rüttgner. At Auschwitz, where both Langbein and Rüttgner had been prisoners, the SS guards had made Rüttgner a capo, someone who supervised slave laborers. He was a capo in an electrical detail, explained Langbein. A decent capo. There were some decent capos there, at Auschwitz. In Rüttger's letter to Langbein, he wrote, "I know where Bauger is." Bauger was a loaded name to anyone who had survived Auschwitz. Survivors knew Baugner as the Tiger of Auschwitz. Wilhelm Bauger was a man of indisputable evil. Witnesses watched him murder children on the train ramps with his own hands. In Rüttner's letter to Langbein, he said that he'd filed murder charges against Bauger with the German authorities in Stuttgart. In the spring of 1958, in his capacity as the secretary of the International Auschwitz Committee, Hermann Langbein followed up on Rüttner's tip and discovered that Bauger was working as an accountant in a town outside Stuttgart. There, the Tiger of Auschwitz lived with his wife and children as a family man. Bringing the man to justice was one long obstacle course, said Hermann Langbein. But finally, after several months of delays, Bauger was arrested. There were 22 co-defendants in the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial. With the exception of Richard Beyer, the last commandant of Auschwitz, all the former Auschwitz functionaries had been leading normal lives using their own names. Commandant Beyer had been living as a groundskeeper on an estate near Hamburg under the alias Karl Neumann. Auschwitz adjunct Robert Mulke was working as a merchant in Hamburg at the death camp Mulke had served as Rudolf Hess's right-hand man. Joseph Clair was living in Braunschweig, working at an auto body shop called Busing & Sons. Clair had been a medical orderly at Auschwitz and had killed thousands with lethal injections to the heart. Oswald Kaduk was living in Berlin working in a nursing home. At Auschwitz, Kaduk beat people to death with his boot. SS pharmacist Dr. Victor Capasius was living in Göppingen, a wealthy pharmacy and beauty shop owner. At Auschwitz, Capasius had assisted the notorious Dr. Mengele in selecting individuals for medical experiments and had managed the death camp's supply of Zyklon B. With the actions of all these men under scrutiny at the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial, Germany faced its past through the lens of its own jurists, not American judges. Many young Germans paid attention and began to wonder how so many war criminals could have gotten away with so many war crimes for so long. More important to the Operation Paperclip legacy is that when Rüttner filed his civil suit, he named another name, Dr. Otto Ambrose. Ambrose was listed as a criminal in the Rüttner complaint because he had been general manager of IG Farben's Buna factory at Auschwitz. German prosecutors looked into the Ambrose case and saw that Ambrose had already been tried and convicted of war crimes at Nuremberg and that he had served 17 months and 2 weeks at Landsberg prison. They decided not to press charges against him a second time. In December 1963, however, Ambrose was called to testify at the trial, which was held in the Ruhr, Frankfurt's town hall. This brought Ambrose into the limelight once again. By 1964, Ambrose had been a free man for 13 years. He was an extremely wealthy, successful businessman. He socialized in Berlin among captains of industry and the professional elite. When the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial started, he was a board member of numerous major corporations in Germany, including AEG, Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, Germany's General Electric, Hibernia Mining Company, and SKW, Süddeutsche Kohlenstoff Werke AGOI, a chemical company. On the witness stand at the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial, Ambrose gave testimony that contradicted statements he had made during his own trial at Nuremberg in 1947. He also said that the conditions at the Auschwitz-Buna factory had been cozy and that the workers had enjoyed good hospitality, which many Auschwitz survivors found appalling in its offensiveness. While contradictory statements might have gone unnoticed by Frankfurt's judges and jurors, there were a number of high-profile Israeli journalists in the courtroom who had become experts on the subject and caught Ambrose's lies. These journalists began at once to investigate Otto Ambrose's post-Nuremberg life. Here was a man who had been convicted of slavery and mass murder and had served very little time considering the crimes. The Farben slaves at Auschwitz numbered 60,000, approximately 30,000 of whom had been worked to death. The journalists covering the trial were outraged by what they discovered. Otto Ambrose now sat on the board of directors of numerous private corporations, but he was also on the board of directors of five companies that were owned by the Federal Republic of Germany. The exorbitant fees Ambrose commanded in these positions were being paid by the German taxpayer. An Israeli female journalist, identified in Bundesarchive documents only as Frau Deutschgren, became so incensed by the arrogance and hubris she saw in Otto Ambrose's post-war life that she wrote a letter to the State Minister of Finance, Ludgar Westrich, that the Federal Republic of Germany was paying a consulting fee of 12,000 Deutschmarks, about $120,000 in today's dollars, to a convicted war criminal was shameful, Frau Deutschgren said. She demanded that Finance Minister Ludger Westrich meet with her. He agreed. Frau Deutschgren could not have known that Otto Ambrose and Finance Minister Ludger Westrich were business colleagues and apparently on very friendly terms, as State Archive correspondence reveals. After the meeting, Westrich promised to look into the matter. Instead, he told Ambrose what was going on. In an effort to hold on to his lucrative and prestigious positions on company boards, Ambrose produced a summary of the allegations against himself and his Nuremberg co-defendants, written by his attorney, a Mr. Duval. Ambrose asked Finance Minister Westrich to circulate this apologia around the various boards on his behalf. As a short summary of our case shows, you will clearly find out we are innocent, Ambrose explained, referring to charges of slavery and genocide that he and his Farben colleagues were convicted of at Nuremberg. I and my colleagues are the victims of the Third Reich, Ambrose insisted. The former government utilized the success of synthetic rubber, which they used to make a profit. If there had been anything against me, then I would never have been released by the American military. U.S. High Commissioner John J. McCloy had granted Ambrose clemency under intense political pressure, a fact now being used by Ambrose to suggest that he had been wrongly convicted at Nuremberg. In a letter dated April 25, 1964, Ambrose reminded Finance Minister Westrich that after he had been released from Landsberg Prison in 1952, you helped me get back on the boards. For this, Ambrose said he was grateful. I see it as an honor and a duty to remain there. I do this for pure altruistic reasons. I appreciate anything you can do. In turn, Finance Minister Westrich wrote letters to the various boards on Ambrose's behalf. Ambrose was chosen for the board because of exceptional talent, Westrich said. In his field, he is as wanted as Wernher von Braun. Everyone wants him. He can get a job anywhere he wants, anywhere in the world. The Israeli journalists refused to let up on Otto Ambrose. They continued to write news stories about him, making it increasingly difficult for both the Federal Republic of Germany and the publicly traded companies on whose boards Ambrose sat to maintain business associations with him. Former war criminal found refuge in Switzerland, read a headline on June 6, 1964. The story detailed time that Ambrose spent in the Swiss village of Pura. Ambrose, furious, submitted a statement of facts to Labor Ministry State Secretary Ludwig Kattenstroff in response. I did not hide myself in Pura, Ambrose wrote. It is my holiday home, and I have to say that when I bought the parcel there in 1956, I informed the Swiss government by handing over the judgment at Nuremberg. I am only there for holidays. My children go there, and my friends. After consulting with my lawyer, I will never go back. Then came the blaming. The whole affair, wrote Ambrose, has to be seen in the shadow of the Frankfurt trial. A certain faction of the press is trying to blame me. The subtext was that the Jews were trying to blame him. In the late summer of 1964, AEG's board members met and decided that they could no longer retain convicted war criminal Otto Ambrose. Ambrose then also quietly left at least two of the five taxpayer-funded consulting positions he held on Federal Republic of Germany boards. In separate letters to Finance Minister Ludger Vestrick and Deputy Finance Minister Dr. Dollinger, a new secret was revealed, though Ambrose promised not to make public a piece of the information they shared. Concerning the firms abroad, where I am a permanent co-worker advisor, Ambrose wrote, I won't name them publicly because I don't want to tip off any journalists who might cause trouble with my friends. You know about W.R. Grace in New York, and I hope I can stay with Hibernia Company. Concerning the firms in Israel, Ambrose wrote, stating their names publicly would be very embarrassing because they are run by very public, well-respected persons in public positions that have actually been at my home and are aware of my position, how I behaved during the Reich, and they accept this. The well-respected public figures in Israel to whom Ambrose referred have never been revealed. That Ambrose had also worked for the American company W.R. Grace would take decades to come to light. When it did in the early 1980s, the public would also learn that Otto Ambrose worked as a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, formerly the Atomic Energy Commission, to develop and operate a plant for the hydrogenation of coal in a scale of 4 million tons per year at the former IG Farben industry, that a convicted war criminal had been hired by the Department of Energy sparked indignation, and congressmen and journalists sought further details about Ambrose's U.S. government contract. In a statement to the press, the Department of Energy insisted that the paperwork had been lost. The scandal was brought to the attention of President Ronald Reagan. Letters on White House stationery reveal that Deputy National Security Advisor James W. Nance briefed Reagan about how it was that the U.S. government could have hired Otto Ambrose. Nance's argument to the president was that many others hired him. Dr. Ambrose had contracts with numerous officials from allied countries, wrote Nance. Dr. Ambrose was a consultant to companies such as Distillers Limited of England, Pechiney, the French chemical giant, and Dow Europe of Switzerland. He was also the chairman of Knoll, a pharmaceutical subsidiary of the well-known chemical corporation BASF. President Reagan requested further information from the Department of Energy on its Ambrose contract. Nance told the president, the DOE and or ERDA, the Energy Research and Development Administration, do not have records that would answer the questions you asked in the detail you requested. However, with Dr. Ambrose's involvement in the company shown and his special knowledge in hydrogenation of coal, we know there were productive contracts between Dr. Ambrose and U.S. energy officials. Even the President of the United States could not get complete information about an Operation Paperclip legacy. In the midst of the scandal, a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle telephoned Ambrose at his home in Mannheim, Germany, and asked Ambrose about his 1948 conviction at Nuremberg for mass murder and slavery. This happened a very long time ago, Ambrose told the reporter. It involved Jews. We do not think about it anymore. The third act of Dr. Kurt Blome's life contradicts the idea that the Soviets were desperately trying to hire Hitler's former biological weapons maker. In February 1962, a group of communist physicians from Karl Marx University in Leipzig, East Germany, sent an open letter to all the doctors and dentists living in Dortmund, as well as many widely distributed newspapers, regarding the matter of the Dortmund physician, Dr. Kurt Blomme. The letter listed the war crimes Blomme had been accused of at the Nuremberg doctor's trial, and stated that everyone in the town of Dortmund should know who he is and what he did to the Jewish people. The Leipzig doctors identified the doctor in Dortmund as the Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich. They wrote that Western German medical colleagues should distance themselves from this man who dares to call himself a doctor. Blomme was contacted by the East German radio station Radio Berlin International for comment. He agreed, and an interview was arranged for February 22, 1962. "I have read the two pages you have presented to me," Blomme told his interviewer on the appointed day. "During the war, I got the task to prepare a serum, a vaccine, against a bacterial plague. This all started because Major General Dr. Schreiber told a lie. Schreiber is a pawn of the Russians. It's a sworn lie." Blomme spent the rest of his radio time blaming Schreiber for his own misfortunes. He ended by pointing out his innocence. Blomme reminded the radio announcer that he had endured a 10-month trial at Nuremberg. "I was acquitted on every point that there was," Blomme said. "The U.S. judges were not easy. They handed out 7 death penalties and 5 lifelong imprisonments. If I had been guilty, they would have convicted me." The allegations opened a subsequent investigation into Blomme. 2 weeks later, on April 4, 1962, the state's attorney in Dortmund wrote to the Central Office of the State Justice Administration for the Investigation of National Socialist Crimes to see if there was anything on Dr. Kurt Blomme. The state's attorney put together a dossier on Blomme, with most of the focus on a letter Blomme had written on November 18, 1942, to Reich Governor, Reichsstatthalter, Arthur Karl Greiser, mayor of a Polish area near Posen, and subsequently executed for war crimes. The subject matter was Sonderbehandling, or special treatment, of Poles with tuberculosis. By now, in 1962, it had been established that Sonderbehandlung was a Nazi euphemism for extermination. In this 1942 correspondence, Blomme and Greiser agreed that the best way to deal with this group of tubercular Poles being discussed was to give them special treatment. But Blomme also raises a problem that had to be dealt with, namely that if these tubercular Poles were to be exterminated, the general perception by relatives would be that something unorthodox is going on. Blomme reminds Reich Governor Greiser that the group they are proposing special treatment for totals approximately 35,000 people. Blomme was called into an interview with the state's attorney. "I am aware that there is an investigation," Blomme said. "My position is that this has already been investigated by the Americans." Dr. Blomme then made the same argument he had used at Nuremberg as a defendant in the doctor's trial, that he may have recommended the extermination of 35,000 Poles as a course of action, but that there was no proof that that action ever took place. Intent, Blomme maintained, is not a crime. Furthermore, Blomme told investigators, "I want to add that I put the blame on Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber based on what I learned at the trial." Blomme said that Dr. Schreiber was the true murderer and that he had framed Dr. Blomme to deflect the guilt away from himself. After several days of consideration, On May 21, 1962, the state's attorney placed the investigation of Dr. Bloma on hold. Bloma continued to practice medicine in Dortmund, and the case against him was never reopened. 3 years later, Bloma was dead. He died of